Hey, it's Kathy. Before we get into today's episode, I have something so cool to tell you about. I'm kicking off a free training. It's a free 5-day abundance activation challenge. It starts on May 6th, and I'll be going live every day with you to give you the practical tools that you need to become a master manifester and create more abundance in your life. If you're curious about manifesting and elevating your vibration to start attracting more abundance, if you want tools you can use to tap into the high vibe energy at the drop of a hat, or you're simply seeking truth and joy in life, this challenge is designed for you. I'll be covering the practices and tools to tune your vibration, claim your worth, and co-create with the universe. It's just going to be so much fun. This is the thing that I have been most excited to put together, and I have been working on this behind the scenes really for the last 2 years, and it's finally here. And if you wanted to just do a deep dive into all the spiritual and all the energetic tools that really you can use that are right here, that are within you, that will allow all these incredible gifts that are hidden in plain sight already to start being a part of your life. I'm so excited for this. We always have so much fun, but this is actually something I've been working on for over 2 years, and it's finally here. So save your spot now. You can sign up for free at kathyheller.com/5-day, and that's the number 5.
This is what you're going to do. You're going to stop on the way home and get food you really want. You're going to get yourself flowers. And from now on, you are going to have a romance with yourself. And what everybody else needs and wants comes after you taking care of your own needs and wants. You're going to say no to a lot more things. Every day, you're going to say no to something. No is a complete sentence. You're going to become your own priority.
Hey guys, it's Kathy Heller. Welcome back to the Kathy Heller podcast. I hope you had a really good weekend. We are visiting Florida and I took my kids to see a production of Hamilton, first time I've ever seen it. And it's just been nice to have family time. We're actually starting the holiday of Passover tonight. And so as a special extra episode, Rabbi David Aaron will be on the podcast this week. So look out for that episode probably Thursday. And you'll get to hear some beautiful messages of love. And I just think it's amazing every time we have him on that people are so touched by his words. But I think especially over this holiday for me, it's extra meaningful. And I think that there are such universal messages in what he has to say. So you can look out for that extra episode this week. So today we have the lovely Anne Lamott here. She's back on the show. She's a New York Times bestselling author of 20 books that have sold millions of copies worldwide. She's also a writing teacher, a speaker, and an activist. You may be familiar with her many popular books like Bird by Bird, Almost Everything, Hallelujah Anyways, Dusk, Night, Dawn. And this month, she released her 20th book. It's called Somehow, Thoughts on Love, and it's all about the transformative power love has in our lives, how it surprises us, forces us to confront uncomfortable truths, reminds us of humanity, and guides us forward. It's interesting because the episode you're going to hear this week with Rabbi Aaron is also all about love. And I just think it's really powerful that this whole week, that's really what the message is about. I think you're going to love this conversation with Anne Lamott. She shared her own story of getting married for the first time at 65, talked about her sobriety journey, navigating love in her friendships and family, and learning to give herself the radical self-love that had been missing for so long. It's a really honest exploration into the complicated nature of love. And I think that this message is something that we all need. So you might want to go get yourself a copy of her book. It's an honor to have Anne back on the show to listen to her wisdom, her vulnerability, and her amazing sense of humor. I know you'll love what she's going to share, so let's get into it. Without further ado, please welcome Anne Lamott. So welcome back. It is wonderful to have you here. I told you the first time that I met you that when people ask me what's one of the best books ever, I can't not talk to them about your work. And when I asked you what was one of your favorite books, I love that you said Women, Food, and God, which is one of my favorite books. And I thought, that's just awesome. You've done it again. You wrote another book, but this is the kind of book that everybody needs. I feel like this is the message. Like, this is the tale as old as time. This is what we're all coming home to over and over again. And you do such a great job in this new book of helping us understand and sort of make more space in a new way.
Oh, thank you.
What made you want to write this book?
Well, my last few books have been about things like hope and mercy and healing and getting through each day that can be sometimes so scary or so disappointing or so whatever, fraught. But everywhere I go on book tours, people would feel pretty hopeless. They feel hopeless about the climate realities. They feel hopeless about the ugliness of the political scene. They feel really scared for their children, their nieces, their nephews. And I've been trying to write more about the enormous amount of hope there is in the ordinary world, just looking out one's window. But then I started wanting, because I felt the same fear, I wanted to write a book about everything that had ever helped when I was afraid or defeated or in limbo or stuck, that would be compiled in one place for my son and grandson after I'm gone. And so everything I started to write about everything that's ever helped me come through, that will almost certainly help them come through whatever the future holds, had to do with love. And so all of a sudden I found myself writing Somehow, which is subtitled Thoughts on Love.
I love that so much. And I completely agree that that is definitely the where the thermostat is set for a lot of people. And in the book, you say, love is our only hope. What does it mean? And how can we know what that really means? Like, how can we fully be love or open up to love if in fact that is our only hope? What does it mean to sort of shift our gaze so that love then actually could be a possibility and then can be our hope?
Well, you said the word gaze, and that makes me think of a priest who helped Bill Wilson in the beginning of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1935. And this priest was not an alcoholic, but he told Bill Wilson, sometimes I think that heaven is just a new pair of glasses. Mm. And so a lot of the stories in Somehow are about feeling this sense of doom and that the sky is falling, or that a couple of very precious friends were either hating me or losing, you know, about to die. And so the question is, in the face of really scary, overwhelming emotions and realities, where do we even start? And I really think about that new pair of glasses a lot, because it's pouring rain right now. The political discourse could not possibly be uglier. There's two horrible wars going on, let alone the extreme deprivation that most people in the world lived with. And so I can't take a walk. And so now I can tell I'm just gaining, you know, 2 and 3 pounds as I sit here talking to you. But you know what? If I put the new pair of glasses, the better pair of glasses on, right outside my window, there are a ton of daffodils in bloom, and they're so pretty. And my kitten is on the bed, and she wasn't eating for a few days, and she's 9 months old. And so, of course, I went to the equivalent of WebMD at 11 at night and realized she had feline leukemia and was going to die. And then also the day before that, she got out. She's an indoor cat and we can hear coyotes. And she'd been out about 20 minutes when I realized she'd been killed and that we would find, you know, her little body with her head eaten off by the coyote. And this, I think this stuff, you know, I came from a dysfunctional family, a lot of alcohol, mental illness, affairs, eating disorders, everything. And I automatically have this negative thinking. But you know what? The kitten is fine. And now I'm convinced she's eating too much. And so I could put on the new pair of glasses and look around and just see so much blessing and just so much stuff that I love about life that has always worked and that is working still today. My friend had a terrible court case this morning with somebody with a bottomless pocketbook to fight her. And about 10 minutes before I started talking to you, she had won a really big victory. It wasn't the trial, but you know, and if I have the new pair of glasses on, I just get to notice how much works. And when I'm thinking my crazy thoughts about, you know, I always tell people, like, do not go up to WebMD after 6 o'clock at night, because
totally.
The new name for women, WebMD, should probably be, it's probably cancer, you know? Because you go to WebMD and any symptom you have is almost certainly deadly.
It should be called catastrophize.com.
Right.
It's very well said. And the truth is that if you picked any date in any time in the history of humanity, there was always going to be things that were going on, whether it was difficulty finding food or what was going on just with different wars around the world. Or, I mean, there's always a good reason, I guess, to outsource our well-being and say, there's the reason I can't find it.
Right, because right.
There'll never be a shortage of those things.
Right.
And yet, what else is happening that you can choose to focus on, right?
Right.
Like, that's our only choice anyway, what we choose to pursue.
Right, right. And in recovery, people are always reminding you of the story of the Native American grandfather who's telling his young grandchild, every morning I wake up and there's two wolves in my head. One is snarling and destructive and dangerous to me, and one is peaceful and nurturing her cub. And which one are you going to feed? And it's like the scary one is a lot more interesting and caffeinated and mood altering. But it's like I have some choice of what I'm going to focus on.
Yeah, no, it's really true. And I think part of it is that even when we have a tremendous amount of bounty in our lives, our systems can be so dysregulated that an email from someone that's not very nice can upset us for hours. Like, it doesn't even have to be something existential. It could be many little paper cuts that happen that are just... Yeah. Because we're so wounded and we go right back into this like predictable sort of place of armoring our heart. And so that's why I'm curious, what has love taught you? And what would you want to invite people to soften up, to be available to let in?
Well, I quote in the book, my wonderful friend, Duncan Trussell, the comedian, who says that when you first meet him, you're meeting his bodyguard. And if you don't do the deep dive into why you need to stay so protected and armored against people knowing you and loving you, then it's going to be really, really hard to feel the beams of love that really are in the world all the time if you are just open to that. But it's scary to let down our armor. Because when we were younger, when we did, we got hurt. We got bullied. We got pushed off our bikes on the blacktop. I got bullied because I had really different hair. But I think you make a decision that you're going to take off just the armor that protects your kneecaps and down to your feet. Or you're just going to try a little bit. And little by little, you start feeling the warmth of the direct sun. Somehow, it's really about all the different realms that are available to us that have helped me, that have saved me, that have guided me. There's community love. There's radical self-love. There's your best friends. There's romantic love. There's ecstatic love. There's silent. There's quiet love. There's love of the divine. There's love of nature. And I would say those are the main loves that I talk about that have the power to change me if I decide to let them. Because left to my own devices, I was raised by atheist intellectuals, and the battle cry, sort of the mantra of our family, was figure it out. And so you're supposed to figure out your catastrophic, panicky, grudgy thinking with your catastrophic, panicky, grudgy thinking. And it just doesn't work.
That's right.
And so it's possible to change channels, to feed the gentler wolf, or to take the action that will get you out of your cell. So that you can be there for others, which will automatically make you feel better about the whole world. And I've always, I think I probably wrote in somehow that if you want to have loving feelings, do loving things. And so when you're feeling really, really afraid and uptight, if you fill a bag of food for the food pantry over in the more impoverished areas of your county, it's going to make you happy. It's going to give you loving feelings since you're providing the love. So there's love now, where before there was just anxiety and drama and trauma and trying to prepare yourself for what might happen that would be so devastating.
I love that idea. And I love the idea that we can activate it by giving it away.
Yeah.
Giving it away, we feel that we have it.
Yeah. Same with hope. When you're feeling completely hopeless, if you bring hope to someone, you pack up something really nice and sweet, or you re-gift something for your most annoying aunt, and you drive up to where she is, and she has no hope. She's really old and really infirm and has a bad attitude and has bad political beliefs. And you bring her some hope wrapped up in a newspaper with a pretty ribbon, and you've brought hope into the environment. So now you have some hope.
It's so beautiful. I think that one of the things that's really difficult for a lot of women is without them even being conscious of it, they're so self-critical of themselves and they don't bring enough grace. And I'm curious, like, what do you want to share about the book and what the book might point us to with that?
Well, there's a story in the book that you might remember, the one with my friend Tim. It's called Camellias, and it's when somebody I am a spiritual mentor for really turned on me. And at the end of a conversation said, it's kind of over and I don't want to turn out like you. And that has been, you know, I'm 70, April 10th. And that has been the lifelong fear that if you get to know me too well, you're going to discover that I'm sort of repellent. You know, deep down, I have a disgusting nature instead of like the person that everybody loves and the adorable persona and the people pleasing and all that. And so that whole story is about like, now what? But it was pretty much also what the culture tells women and girls about themselves, which is certainly that the most important thing for a woman is to keep her weight down. And then after that, she should understand that her direct value comes from how appreciated and respected she is with men. Hint, hint, it won't be enough, you know, and it's also an inside job that the respect that you're desperate for and have been trying to manipulate or super achieve your way to all your life. It's an inside job. It's you that's not respecting you. So I remember certain things, and I really hope women are changed somewhat by this book, because when the stories are about really awful problems that have come up that are usually pretty funny at the same time, the solution is almost always this radical self-care, that you stop the thinking however you can. You know, you put on Below Deck and you get a cup of tea and a bag of popcorn, and you do this radical self-care. You start talking to yourself the way I would talk to you, who I've never met in person, the way I would talk to a girlfriend who is really having an awful experience. I wouldn't say, snap out of it, or you've got it. This isn't that, you know, I wouldn't talk to her like that. I would say, oh boy, I get it. I've been there. I was there last week, and this is what helped and this is what didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you say when there have been people who have really opened their heart and they've been really, really hurt and they are really scared to open their heart again?
Well, a lot of the book on love is how what you said is my deepest belief, that only love can save us, but also nothing has caused us more pain and hopelessness than love that's gone south on us. Love, that unrequited love, the love we didn't get when we needed it most, the healthy love we didn't get as children. And so all truth is paradox, I believe. And so when people have given up or have just gotten too afraid to be loved, you know, it's one day at a time. And it's like the same way you get to Carnegie Hall, you know, practice, practice, practice. You become aware that the bodyguard is keeping people out. You become aware that you're scared to death that people will know you too well. That's probably been my lifelong fear. And so you practice and you let one person know you. Like, I see my love and my honesty realms as sort of a bullseye. And in the center is me and the little girl, Annie, and God, period. And then in the first bullseye ring out, first ring out from the bullseye is my husband and my son and my two best friends, a girlfriend and a man friend. And I will tell them anything. I do believe that we're as sick as our secrets. And if our secret is that we really, really can't let anyone in, if you just tell it to one of those people, they're going to say, do you want me to be your practice, your sparring partner?
Yeah.
Do you want to practice letting me love you? Do you want to practice telling me some secrets that you haven't told anyone else? Because I can almost guarantee you that they're my same secrets. You know, we're all in the same boat. There's a wonderful quote somewhere by one of my favorite authors, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who wrote 100 Years of Solitude. Oh my God, it's so brilliant. He said, there's our public life, our personal life, and our secret life. And so our public life, you know, we've got these personas. We've had a lot of things working out for us career-wise. We know how to have people like us, da da da. Our private life is with just a handful of people that we really let know us, and that somebody, not everyone knows every secret, but somebody knows every secret. I don't have a secret. Not one of them knows And then the fly in the ointment, my secret life, where I still get so jealous of other writers who are doing better. I'm so judgmental. I have such a shadowy, dark, judgmental ticker tape going on inside of me all the time. You know, I'm like everybody. I can be so petty. I can be absolutely so self-obsessed. I can feel on some days like a walking personality disorder, and that's in my secret life. So the way home for me is to go find Neil or Sam, my husband or son, or to call a girlfriend, pick up that 200-pound phone and say, I want to tell you what's going on for me right now. I am in complete separation from myself, from life, from God, and from all my friends because I'm being so mean to myself, or because I have such a fearful new realization about myself and that I'm flawed. And no one is going to say, boy, that's too bad that you're like that, because that really isn't an issue for me. I don't judge and I'm never jealous. And I just always feel that it's not a zero-sum game and plenty for everyone. First of all, I'd never call someone like that. In fact, I would never be friends with somebody like that. But I make sure that when I tell, I'm going to tell one of three friends and they are going to get it. They're going to grok it. You know, they're going to go, I get that entirely. I have been there. It is so toxic and painful. I am pretty sure the only thing that can help you is if I come get you and we go to Target. Or they'll come and they'll say, did you eat today? Did you have a bad night's sleep? And if you had a bad night's sleep, they're not going to say, well, you've got to get your sleep happy. You know, they're not going to say that. They said, God, I woke up Monday morning and I think I slept for a total of 4 hours and I was cranky and I hated all of life and blah, blah, blah. And what I did was I read some Mary Oliver. What I did was I went for a 45-minute walk and it was raining and I put on my raincoat and it hit the reset button for me. I was so blown away. You know, my husband in the book and somehow has that wonderful line that begins the book, that everything true and beautiful can be discovered on any 10-minute walk, whether you're in the city or in nature or in whatever. And so you can kind of at gunpoint, or it's sort of like Winnie the Pooh. Remember Christopher Robin's pop gun? At sort of Christopher Robin's pop gun point, you can get yourself outside. You can say, we're going outside. We're going to walk down to the park. It's 10 minutes each way. And we're in, I don't want to. I'm cold. My feet hurt. And you say, I know, I understand that, but we're just going to go. And, you know, another thing, she'll laugh when I say this. I can see I'm a many, many years, if not and decades older than you. But when I was coming up in the 50s and 60s, the most famous pediatrician was named Dr. Spock, not the Star Trek guy. And his book on childbearing and baby raising was what every parent read. And he said, with two-year-olds, you need to be firm, but friendly. And so with my writing, when I don't want to write, which I have to say is a lot of the time, when I don't want to go for a walk, when I don't want to do something that will give me a feeling of uplift and self-esteem, I think of Dr. Spock and I think you have to be firm but friendly. And I'll say, Annie, you know what? We're going to walk into town and we're going to go to the health food store and we're going to have them make us a burrito. And I know it's really fattening. And I really believe we need ballast today. And I feel that that's your favorite taste. So I'm going to go get you one. So come with me.
It's just so delightful. I love that you're one of the most important, prolific writers of our time. And you're the most down to earth, approachable, non-pretentious person. It's just really so delightful. Of course, God would make it so. You talk a lot in this book about this very beautiful love affair that came later in your life.
Yeah.
I feel like that gives people tremendous hope. How did you guys meet? And why do you think at that time in your life, you were available for that kind of love?
Well, first of all, your listeners can for free go online and read Anne Lamott and Match.com. Because what I did before meeting Neil was have a year on Match that was kind of a nightmare, but also I didn't know how to date. I'd always just kind of known who the next hostage was going to be. You know, you look around, maybe you go a year and then somebody appears and then you try to bring them up to snuff and fix them. So I just learned to date. I learned to have coffee with men. I learned how to say no. I learned to listen to my intuition and my instinct. I learned what I really was not going to settle for. And what I decided during that time was that I wanted a man who I felt I could talk to forever. We would always be able to talk about politics and spiritual matters and books and movies and family. Those are my favorite things to talk about. And I wanted a man who was so good and so cool that if he were a woman, he'd be my best girlfriend. Because before I'd been with these men and they might have been well-known or attractive or for whatever, but secretly, if they had been women, they wouldn't have been my best girlfriend. You know, they would have been someone I was glad to run into sometimes. So that was my boundary. And so then after about 6 months off of Match, I went back on. There's a match for older people called Our Time. And I did the same thing. I had coffee with inappropriate men. I'm pretty well known in my county and I look just like me. So men would bring manuscripts. One man asked on our second date if it was too soon to bring a plot treatment. So it was different. Yeah, as God is my witness. And I said, yes, it's a little too early. And I had really liked him and thought he was funny and cool until then. And then it was like, it will be too soon, this side of the grave, you know? So I saw this guy on Match that was really attractive, possibly overeducated, deeply overeducated, really tall, 6'4" or 6'3", which is, I'm like 5'6", but had a wonderful profile. So I wrote to him, and the thing was, he was allergic to cats. And I love my cat. My grandchild lives here, so I couldn't be at a man's house all the time because he'd need to be here a lot of the time. And so I just sort of let it go. I didn't think of it. Then about 3 months later, I was scrolling through and I saw this really attractive man, possibly overeducated, really tall. And I loved his profile. And I wrote and I said, I love your profile. And he wrote back, you've already rejected me. I don't think I was Jesus-y enough for you. And I wrote back, I said, I could care less. And I mean that literally, whether you are Jesus-y at all. I do need someone who's on a spiritual path. That's just who I am. But I stopped writing because I remember you were allergic to cats. So then he told me he has severe cat allergies, but he has a system of dealing with it. We sleep with a cat. And so I agreed to meet him for coffee. And within about 15 minutes, every single book I had ever loved turned out to be a book that he had read and sometimes twice. Every movie he had ever seen twice and possibly more often than that over the last 50 years was a movie that I had seen more than, you know, and we were just jamming. Now, we haven't been apart for one day unless one of us has had to go out of town without the other. So it was like, there's a story in somehow, I'm pretty sure. You've read it more recently than I have because I don't read my own work after it's published. Yes, it is in here, I think, about what women without intervention do, which is to take care of the rest of the world and be flight attendants for everyone in their family and make sure they were tended to and have them be the priority and always be thinking about what they need and how to help them feel better about their lives. Well, one day, it's in the book, so I'll tell the short form, I just lost it. I was just done. I don't know why I hadn't been the day before. And I got in the car and I drove out to the woods about 20 minutes away and I screamed and shouted and cried the whole way. And I shouted at my son, my grandchild, my grandchild's mother, my brothers, all the people I love most, and my parents who are long dead. I said, I am so sick of this way of living where everybody comes ahead of me and I take leftovers. And if an egg yolk breaks, I take the broken egg, which is something my mother had always done. And I was just ugly crying, just ugly red-eyed, red-nosed, red-faced crying. And when I was done, I drove back home and I parked by the side of the road and I called my spiritual mentor, whose name I always called her Horrible Bonnie because she was always so optimistic no matter what. And I called her. I just said, I'm just sick of this. I hate this. I'm sick of them. They make me sick. People are sucking me dry. I'm nobody's priority. And there was a long silence. And then she said, the reason you're nobody's priority is because you're not your own priority. And this moment is what we've paid for. Because she'd been mentoring me for 30 years, almost how long I'd been sober. I've been sober 37. I think she'd been mentoring me for 35. So she said, this is what you're going to do. You're going to become your own priority. You're going to stop on the way home and get food you really want. You're going to get yourself flowers. It can be a little bouquet. And from now on, you are going to have a romance with yourself And what everybody else needs and wants comes after you taking care of your own needs and wants. You're going to say no to a lot more things. Every day you're going to say no to something. No is a complete sentence. And I thought about it. And you know what? When all else fails, follow instructions, and all else had been failing, I was desperately lonely. And I decided to do what she'd said. And I followed instructions, and I had a kind of an active romance with myself. And I released everybody to their own higher powers, which turns out not to be me. And I surrendered to mine, which also turns out not to be me. And 3 months later, I came upon this profile that was Neil in Match.com.
Oh, it's so delightful and wonderful, and it's beautiful. And this is an incredible gift that you just gave in so many ways. And there's so many pieces in that that are each a gift. And this last piece about that love affair with yourself and getting yourself the bouquet and making yourself a priority. I feel like everyone needs to pull over to the side of their life right now.
Yeah.
And ask themselves, are you doing that? And have you ever done that? What a radical question.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. To ask is, are you your own priority? And what could happen that would allow you to be? And how could that change your feeling of love for the world? You started to have a full cup. So it's exquisite. And I'm sure that the love that the two of you have, Neil and yourself together, and I feel like it probably is a walking billboard for possibility for other people.
It is. And it's also real life with two people that are set in their ways and that are imperfect and that can be annoying. And it's about real life. It's about how do you deal with stuff when you're really uncomfortable with something the other has done? What do you do? We have a lot of kids between us. I have one and he has four. And they're all in their 30s, and they all are used to us being there for at their beck and call. And now we're at each other's beck and call, but it's complicated. And some days go better than others, and some days are just too long. And some days I cry. I wrote about how in the book somehow how different we are when things aren't working out for us, and how I walk out quietly in a deeply victimized way, like the little match girl. And I go to my bedroom. And then he stomps around like a lawyer, like shaking his briefs at me. And he has to be right. He's a know-it-all. And I don't have to be right. I just want everybody to be extremely nice to me. And so then he comes into the bedroom. But by then, I'm scarily quiet. I've weaponized my quietness. And then he goes off, but he's not stomping now. Then he panics because he realizes he's doomed without me. And then he comes back. This might take 2 hours altogether. Then he comes back and he sits on the bed, and I might still be crying. And we just have these deep, deep, miserable, painful talks that start off with, I don't know how I'm going to make this right for you, or vice versa. And then we come through.
Yeah. It's so beautiful. And my husband and I were recently on a marriage retreat. We had maybe done one of those one other time in 17 years, but we had gone on this retreat, and it was actually, I don't know if you know Bob Goff, but he's a gorgeous.
I love Bob. Yeah. Oh,
he's such a gorgeous human.
Oh, so yeah.
It was a retreat that he runs. And we realized that he said something so profound, which is the love we're looking for in each other is called perfect love that you only get from the divine. And
yeah.
What's so beautiful about that story of you sitting on the edge of the bed is that you're just walking beside each other, you know, because you want the other person to be responsible to give you that perfect love.
And right. They can't. Right.
They can't.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So the other thing you talk about is what you've already mentioned, and it's part of your journey, but you talk about in the book, again, your sobriety journey, as well as your son's, his journey with all of that. And there is so much radical love that you have to reach for to become sober. And what do you want people to know about that this time? Because you've talked about that in the past, but you're talking about it again in the book now. What do you want people to understand about love as it relates to sobriety?
It's a great question. I could write a whole book about it. Maybe I just did. But off the cuff, I got sober in July of 1986. And I had God in my life. I had a church. I'd converted. But I had a God who thought I was a piece of you-know-what because of the way I'd lived as an alcoholic woman, all the boundaries I'd crossed, all the hurt I'd caused, all the endless betrayals to people who trusted me and to myself. And so when I got sober, the women who were helping me were helping me take a look at how I came up with that. I mean, I had atheist parents. I could kind of come up with any kind of God I wanted to, and I'd come up with one that was extremely disappointed, if not annoyed on most days, or disgusted. And so I started to do the deep dive into why I couldn't love myself at all. And it really dovetailed with why I didn't think God could love me as is. And little by little, when I was starting to live in a more gentle and esteemable way and not hurting people or myself, little by little, coincidentally, I started to experience God as a friend and as somebody who thought I was great, but obviously needed a lot of help some days. You know, it is hard to get sober. It's hard to be a writer. It's hard to be a parent. I had a little boy. I got pregnant about 6 months before my third sobriety birthday, and I didn't have any money, and the man wasn't sticking around. And so that was a very deep hole, you know, and it was clear to me that God was going to get into the hole with me and that was going to provide that divine love through my best friends, my brothers, my spiritual community, my church, my recovery community, and my neighbors. And there wasn't a day that I didn't feel like God was a total show off, you know, that there would be such good news, or I'd get an assignment that was going to pay for 2 months' rent, which I'd never done before.
Wow.
And so I think that for me, and I say this a lot in the book, the hard work we do is finding a way to love and accept who we are, and that we came this way and then we were indoctrinated into ways of thinking of ourselves that were totally destructive, that you needed to stay thin. You needed to bring home A's, a B plus was close, but no cigar, that you needed to have a personality that men found charming and winsome, that you needed not to do better than men because they wouldn't find you as charming and winsome. There were just so many things that you learned to do that were so self-destructive. And so once you start unpacking that and you stop doing them, we start catching yourself much more early in a day or so instead of like my entire 20s, then you have a chance at feeling really affectionate to your perfectly imperfect self. And that's, I think, when we start to understand God as goodness and love and friendship.
It's so beautiful. And it's reminding me that one of the most toxic things to experience is shame. There's something about grief and pain that we can be with, even though it's so painful, but there's something about shame that is like a cancer. It's so toxic. Your body you can't be with it because it's a insistence on not accepting something about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what you just shared is so vulnerable and so radically gorgeous, because if everyone would just set down the shame and understand that there is going to be a brokenness, period, you're liberated. I mean,
you're halfway home. Yeah. You know, Eugene O'Neill said, man is born broken. The grace of God is glue. And once you understand, you stop pretending that you're not broken. When you start to live in the miracle that you've been issued life, and that there's still some streaks and some bad thoughts and some ego issues and whatnot, but that you're a work in progress, I just think you're halfway home. And then you can start dealing with yourself the way that you would with a close friend. Can I tell you, I know you've read this in my stuff before, but can I tell you the Tom Weston thing about shame? Okay. He's my very dear Jesuit friend who leads workshops. And he told me 30 some years ago, he said, this is what it's like for most American adults. 5 rules. 1, you must not have anything wrong with you or different about you, right? 2, if you do have something wrong with you or different about you, you really have to correct it or get over it as soon as possible. 3, if you can't get over it or correct it, you just have to pretend it's not a problem anymore. And just, it's like that old thing that used to be. The 4th thing is that if you can't even pretend you've corrected it, you shouldn't show up, because it's just so painful for the rest of us to see you in your current condition. And the 5th rule is that if you're going to insist on the right to show up, you should at least have the decency to be ashamed. And I believe for every person I know and every writer I've ever worked with, that is the boulder in the road, is that we agree to that. that we tried not to have anything wrong with us, but we knew there was, we're human.
Right.
We're a mixed grill. You know, we're darkness and light. We're light and shadow. And you tried so hard to get over it. And, you know, I had this kinky hair and I went through probably a 55-gallon drum of dippity-doo in the 60s trying to make it straight. And I did this and I've tried to keep my weight down and I've tried to this and I tried to bring home all, and I did this and I could not get over the fact that I was deeply human. And then when I showed up, the secret was that I had shame. I created this persona where you might not notice it right away. I was seductive. I was charming. I was successful. I was all those things. But inside I had that feeling, that sometimes vague feeling of shame and sometimes much more acute. So if I were going to tell your listeners, and on the book tour, one place to start with a healing journey to a life that is much more expansive and sweet, it would be to start on your own emotional acre, to get off everybody else's emotional acre, close the gate on yours, and start to do the very tough work of learning to love yourself, learning to be a friend to yourself, learning to find some kind of humor in a lot of it instead of that terror that the jig is up, you know, or that now everybody can tell who you are and blah, blah, blah. So I would just start with the journey of self-respect and self-love, because I can tell you, this is my 20th book, and the respect is not out there. That you can have good reviews and you feel like the FDA has stamped your card of approval, and the next day you get bad reviews. I'm going to get bad reviews mixed in with some good reviews. And you can't go by that. It's an inside job. How can I respect myself if I get a bad review? Well, yeah, but, you know, I'll probably call my best friend and make her really judge the reviewer really harshly and tear apart their really pathetic and meager career and bad attitude. But I would just tell people it's an inside job. Everything you are searching for is already inside you. And my priest friend, Terry Ritchie, who's just passed, elderly Franciscan, he said, the point is not to try harder. The point is to resist less. And my whole life was about trying harder and doing better and ranking higher and scoring better and whatnot. And it didn't work. It didn't work. You know, we do have God-shaped holes inside of us. And everything I shoved into those God-shaped holes to try to feel nurtured or full or of value just made the holes bigger.
Totally. 100%. For me, I also grew up with no connection to God in my house. And then after college, I wound up taking like a quick trip to Jerusalem. And I was so touched by being there that I stayed there for 3 years and fell in love with God. And one of the things that was just mind-blowing to me was that a rabbi told me that love is not earned. Like, you don't have to earn love. Like, God doesn't need you to earn it.
Yeah.
And I couldn't believe that thought existed. I couldn't believe that that was a concept. And the fact that it's just grace, the fact that it just is.
Yeah.
It just is because it is. I think most people grew up in a house where it felt like business, not love.
Right. It was negotiated.
If you're thin, you get love. Yeah. If you get straight A's, you get love. If you, if you're pleasing.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think what you're saying is unlearning for all of us that you don't have to keep trying, because love is just a gift.
Yeah. And grace, the reason it's called grace, it's like when I grace something or the land, you know, it means an unwarranted gift. It's always sort of a surprise, because I always look in certain directions for the hope to come or the solution or whatnot. And the movement of grace in my life, it's kind of like it gooses me or something, you know? I've always described it as being the spiritual WD-40, where you go from clench and uptight and whatnot, and you get spritzed with this stuff. You know how WD-40 has those long, thin red straws?
Yeah.
It gets in there, and it spritzes you, and you get your sense of humor back. And I always say the same thing, that laughter is carbonated holiness. And once you get your sense of humor back, you're home. You're back home. And I wrote many books ago that I don't understand the mystery of grace, but it meets you exactly where you are, and then it doesn't leave you where it found you. But they call it the mystery of grace for a good reason, because it's very mysterious now.
Yeah. And one other thing that this same rabbi shared with me, he said, you know, God is perfect and we are imperfect, which means he said, God is in awe of us because God doesn't have the capacity to do anything wrong. But the fact that we do and we can choose to do something different is awesome. And I never looked at it that way. He's like, that's a greater level than anything because you have a choice. And to know that you can be angry and stubborn and choose to have the courage that he goes, God is in awe of that. You know, and I thought, what a cool way to flip it, to look at our brokenness as something that then gives us this super strength. So your work is just so beautiful. And in closing, what is one message that you hope that you will leave readers with when they walk away with this particular book?
Well, I hope it's a handbook for them of how big and juicy and spacious their lives can be if they're not already, and that there are paths to this. There are ways of doing Nautilus for the soul so you can build up some muscles of courage to maybe join a community, maybe work at the food pantry or cleaning up the beaches or mentoring underprivileged kids or an ecstatic dance community that you've always, you know, you've watched them dance in the park and you've thought, God, I wish I wasn't so shy. And I hope that the book will help you know that you can enter in shyly and kind of pawing at the ground and whispering, but you stick out your hand and you say hi. And that there is so much hope, no matter how afraid you are, for the young people in your life, your kids, your nieces, nephews, grandchildren. There is so much hope for the future. First of all, old people like me have left the young with the most astonishing scientific cache of knowledge and equipment. And they are so brilliant and they're going to be fine. And that also certain things have always worked. And they will, no matter what the future brings, and they will later today, and they will in 2034. And I hope that maybe by reading this, some of them will stick with you and you won't feel that it's just all way too much, because it's not. One day at a time, it's not. I promise you, it's not.
It's just beautiful. And we need you so much. So thank you for being you and for sharing. And I know it's almost your birthday, and what a beautiful thing for you to stand at the top of the mountain and look back at everything that you've contributed and all that you've journeyed through and how many people you touched along the way. What a beautiful thing to take in on your birthday.
Well, thank you so much. What a great conversation. I loved everything you asked. So thank you for having me.
Yeah. You're so welcome. And so just the book comes out April 9th, everybody. And I'm sure that by the time you hear this, you can go get it. So thank you so much for coming on.
You're so welcome.
I'm sure we'll see you for the next book and the one after that.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. God bless.
God bless you.
It was great to have Anne on the show again. Here are the takeaways. Number one, you can choose what to focus on. Put on a new pair of glasses and look around. You'll see so much blessing and things you love about life that have always worked and that are still working today. Number two, let down your armor and be open to feeling the beams of love that really are in the world. Number three, if you want to have loving feelings, do loving things. Number four, the solution is almost always radical self-care. Number five, take care of your own needs and wants. Have a romance with yourself. Get yourself the bouquet. Become your own priority. Number six, when you start to live in the miracle of life that you've been issued and you accept that you're a work in progress, you can walk yourself home. Number seven, everything you're searching for is already within you. So the point is not to try harder. The point is to resist less. Number eight, it's an inside job. Get off everybody else's emotional anchor and start on your own. Do the very tough work of learning to love yourself, learning to be a friend to yourself. Start with the journey of self-respect and love. Okay, now I want to celebrate the alumni from my podcast program. So shout outs to Isabel Von Follow and her podcast, Victorious You, Deb Carson and her show, Powered by Purpose, Ashley Mayer and her podcast, Life and Business Coaching with Hero in the Mirror, and Gabriela Rojo and her podcast, Leaping into the Void. You are all so amazing. And I love that you gave yourself full permission to speak out and let your voice be heard. Please check out their shows and give your support. We're going to put the links in the show notes. I can never say this enough, but thank you so much for listening to the podcast. You guys mean the world to me. There's a lot of great episodes coming soon. So please make sure that you follow us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you're listening. And if you resonate with anything from today's episode or this show in general, please let us know by leaving a review. Next week, we're going to be doing a giveaway. And if you have entered a review, you will be put in a giveaway to win some really, really cool prizes. So go ahead and leave us a review and then look for the giveaway. I'll be talking about it on my Instagram and you guys can get in on that there. Before we go, I want to remind you that I'm doing a free training. It's a free 5-day abundance activation challenge from May 6th to the 10th. And I would love to see you there. You can sign up at kathyheller.com/5-day. I just know it's going to be so much fun. I'll leave you with a song of mine and I hope you have an amazing week.